So good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk a bit about the theme this week, which is language, how we language our experience. But I'm going to talk about it more, a little more academically. So the title of my talk is Language is cultural. And I'm going to quote from David McMahon's new book, Rethinking Meditation. So the first thing I will quote from the book is this: various articulations of the Dharma contain complex maps of the life world in a particular social imaginary. Now, that's a lot, but a social imaginary, according to David McMahon, refers to the background of sort of the interpersonally shared life world that we all have in a particular society. So going on with this quote, in this way, inchoate or and unconscious impulses, impressions, and notions emerge into consciousness to take the shape of available categories in the traditions and the always already available ways of understanding, the ways we have of understanding within our own culture. So, for example, on Sunday, a meditator, I hope she doesn't mind my sharing this, but a meditator shared that she observed some black blobs which had a lot of clarity moving across her inner vision while meditating. In some traditions, that experience might be attributed to something like a demon or some sort of external force. But of course, in our tradition, we take for granted that this was an internally generated experience, and we pay close attention to the conditions under which that visualization arose, that's the specific visual appearance, and what feelings might be associated with them. So going back to McMahon, here's continuing the quote, the various narratives of progress, maps of the path, models of enlightened persons, and instructions all constitute templates that shape how meditation works in configuring consciousness. For example, so now I'm talking using my own example. For example, in a Tibetan tradition, describing to a teacher the ability to sustain a certain visualization of a deity might be a measure of progress. In Zen, a description of a sudden non-conceptual state of insight might be a measure of progress. I had the experience of doing a fairly brief retreat in Thailand, where the monk who interviewed me asked what percentage of time I was spending thinking. And I said, about 50% of the time. Well, he said, when I reached 25% of the time thinking, he would give me a new meditation instruction and I would go on to something more advanced. In our experience, in our approach, we do not set up any measures of progress. We take each experience that we have and validate it as important. Going back to McMahon's quote, these templates guide meditators toward attending to certain features of their experience, interpreting their significance, categorizing them in certain ways, and acting on them according to prescribed purposes. For example, In the Rinzai school of Zen, only experiences relevant to the koan a student is working on are considered relevant. Other experiences, even very vivid ones, may be considered makyo or extraneous and wouldn't be talked about or even brought, you know, reflected on. And finally, going back to McMahon, I quote, "And they simply may not notice what is not on a particular map." For example, in our approach, we pay close attention to how a particular experience of calm might develop using language like a transition, what came before, what came after, where in another tradition, no notice or language might be given to any of those aspects. In our approach, we might use the word restless to describe a particular physical or mental state and be encouraged to elaborate how that restlessness plays out. In a more traditional setting, restlessness is one of the five hindrances and is something to be avoided or controlled. So no further, you know, articulation of that experience would be measured or encouraged. In our culture, we have access to a lot of neuroscientific terms like amygdala or trauma or being triggered. And in another culture, they would have no access to those terms and might describe a particular experience of strong emotion much differently. We don't use the term bondage in describing, say, a delightful memory of taking a walk in the forest. But in an early Buddhist tradition, that memory might be described as an example of the bondage we still have to the world of samsara. Our language of time passing in meditation, in our approach, because we encourage, we're encouraged to meditate in a, you know, a comfortable posture, and if we have pain or tension, you know, we can make a quick adjustment in our position. So in reflection, our meditation experience probably has a lot less concern, or time is a lot less prominent. I know from my experience, if you're sitting in a traditional Zen meditation hall, where you're supposed to sit up straight, not move, and need to wait for the timekeeper to ring the bell, a lot of the meditation experience, if it were honestly described, might be around pain and anxiety around how much time is left, how much longer until that so-and-so timekeeper rings the bell. Finally, think of some of the descriptive terms we use that other cultures would not have access to. Terms like feministic, non-binary, climate grief, PTSD, and so on. So none of those terms would be available to use in describing a particular meditation experience. I'm going to stop there. Thank you for listening.